September 20th, 1987. Bellingham, Washington. A worker at the Georgia-Pacific pulp mill discovers some skeletal remains inside a chimney on one of the boilers at the mill's steam plant. The victim is determined to be male, but since he has been burned so badly by the extreme heat and cannot be identified, he becomes known as the Bellingham John Doe. Over the years, investigators explore a number of different theories about how the John Doe wound up inside the chimney, but since his remains were carbonized, there are no traces of DNA available to make an identification. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering a very unique case involving an unidentified decedent, the unexplained 1987 death of the Bellingham John Doe. So this one is a special request from a listener who has spent years researching and gathering material about this story. They asked if I would be willing to feature it on my podcast and offered to turn over all of their materials, including the original case file. And I was definitely happy to oblige, because this is one of the most bizarre cases involving an unidentified decedent that I've ever seen. What makes this case so strange is the unusual location where the Bellingham John Doe was found, as his skeletal remains somehow wound up inside a chimney at the Georgia-Pacific pulp mill in Bellingham, Washington. To this day, no one knows whether this man's death was an accident, suicide, or a homicide, but since there was nothing to indicate that he was a current or former employee at the mill, that only adds to the mystery. Even though security at this location was not exactly airtight, the opening to this chimney was not a particularly easy place to find or access, and investigators were unable to determine how long the victim had been down there before he was discovered. Over the years, two eyewitnesses have come forward and provided information about potential scenarios for who the victim might have been and how they wound up dead under these odd circumstances, but they've never been conclusively proven. Now, as you probably know, within the past several years, thanks to the work of such organizations as the DNA Doe Project and Othram Incorporated, DNA profiling and genetic genealogy has led to the identification of hundreds of John and Jane Does. However, that is just not an option in this case, because the heat inside the chimney was so intense that it destroyed all traces of DNA on the remains. The authorities do have this man's dental records on file, but they still need the correct person to compare them to if they have any hope of making a positive identification. So in this episode, I'll be discussing all the different theories surrounding the Bellingham John Doe and why all attempts to give him his name back have been unsuccessful. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the death of the Bellingham John Doe. Our story begins in 1987 in Bellingham, Washington, a coastal city located in Whatcom County, which had a population of around 50,000 people at that time. 24 years earlier, the pulp and paper company, Georgia Pacific, acquired a pulp mill which was located on Bellingham's waterfront. The structure had originally been built in 1938 and had a total of 2 boilers at the mill's 4-story steam plant, but the plant was greatly expanded over the course of the next 5 decades, and by this point, it now has a total of 10 boilers. At 5:21 a.m. on the morning of September the 20th, Roy Harris, an engineer at the Georgia Pacific Mill, noticed there was an alarm at the steam plant as smoke was emanating from Stack 9, the 10-square-foot steel chimney on the plant's number 9 boiler. Since the boiler was not in operation at that time, Harris was worried about a potential water leak, so he climbed to the top of the chimney, which had a 4-foot-wide opening. After using his flashlight to check down the chimney, Harris was shocked to discover what appeared to be some crumpled skeletal remains. They were resting on top of a grid of 11 parallel pipes located near the base of the chimney 17 feet below. After Harris notified emergency services, investigators from the Bellingham Police Department were dispatched to the mill, as well as Dr. Robert Gibb, a pathologist and deputy medical examiner with the Whatcom County Medical Examiner's Office. When Dr. Gibb arrived, he went down into Stack 9 in order to start gathering evidence, and the remains were eventually removed from there. After a forensic investigation was performed, it was estimated that the victim was a male between the ages of 27 and 37 years old, who was around 5'8" or 5'9", weighed between 130 and 155 pounds, and wore a size 8 shoe. He also appeared to have quality dental work, as he had silver and gold fillings inside his teeth, and may have undergone a root canal. It's also worth noting that the original case file contains letters which had been sent to various agencies and alluded to the possibility that the victim may have had dental work done at a military base or a military clinic. There isn't any documentation which specifies where this idea originated from, but since many of the investigators and experts who worked on the case had prior military experience, perhaps they saw some parallels between this man's dentals and dental work they had seen in the service. In 1999, a dentist named Richard Tucker would be consulted about the decedent's dental work, and while he did not find anything distinctive to help with the identification, he estimated that the victim was actually between 40 and 45 years old. The chimney contained charred remnants of numerous articles of clothing, including a denim jacket, denim pants, a lightweight shirt, and a rubber-soled right shoe. In fact, the charred jacket was found directly underneath the remains, suggesting that the victim may have attempted to use it to shield himself from the extreme heat emanating from the pipes. It also appeared that he had attempted to remove his pants and wrap his shirt around his leg, possibly due to the heat or an injury he suffered. Indeed, it was determined that he had a cracked pelvis, as well as numerous fractures in both thigh bones, several lower leg bones, and 2 bones in his right arm, and these injuries were likely caused by the 17-foot drop down the chimney onto the pipes below. It's also been reported that the decedent put his socks over his hands. There was no trace of any identification, rings, keys, a wristwatch, or pocket change with the victim, and while a welder's sparkling tool was found inside the chimney, no one could be certain if it belonged to him, as it may have been left there on a previous occasion by one of the mill's employees. A badly charred bundle of papers was also at the scene, including an item which may have been a wallet, but it was impossible to determine its contents. Perhaps the most intriguing item was a burnt remnant of what appeared to be a ticket or a baggage claim slip from Continental Airlines, but while 6 assorted numbers on the item could be identified by investigators, it was not enough to trace the flight route, buyer, or sales agent. The Bellingham PD got in touch with Harvey Pratt, a forensic artist with the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation, and sent him photographs of the remains. Using the measurements and photos of the skull, as well as the decedent's bone structure as a reference, Pratt put together a forensic reconstruction of what the victim may have looked like. The final composite sketch depicted a shaggy-haired man with a long face and sunken cheeks, but even though this victim's story was publicized by the local media and his sketch was circulated, no one ever positively identified him, and he became known as the Bellingham John Doe. It's also worth noting that in 2000, a Bellingham PD officer named Osborne came up with a second forensic reconstruction of the decedent for circulation. This composite sketch was slightly different than Pratt's, as the John Doe now had shorter hair, a more bulbous nose, a narrower mouth, and fuller cheeks. While the identity of the Bellingham John Doe was a big mystery on its own, what made this case particularly baffling was trying to figure out how and why his remains wound up inside Stack 9. The pipes inside this chimney carried water which was heated by a boiler exhaust in order to create steam for the mill. The standard temperature of the air down there would be around 95 degrees Fahrenheit, while the pipes usually had a temperature of 240 degrees Fahrenheit. But if the boiler was running, the air's temperatures could reach as high as 370 degrees. You'll find a few sources out there which state that John Doe's cause of death was estimated to be hypothermia, but this piece of information is inaccurate and may have been brought upon by a typo or clerical error. The original autopsy report actually lists the estimated cause of death as hyperthermia with an ER, not hypothermia with an O. I actually talked about this on the episode I released a few weeks ago about the unexplained death of Natasha Jennings, but while hypothermia is the result of a dangerously low body temperature, hyperthermia occurs when one experiences a dangerously high body temperature. Even if John Doe fell down the chimney and suffered some injuries after landing on the grid of pipes, he likely did not die immediately, as the remarks on the inside wall to suggest he attempted to climb out. But if he was trapped down there, the decedent would not have been able to withstand the high temperatures indefinitely and probably succumbed to them at some point. Since boiler number 9 was only used occasionally, Stack 9 was not checked that often, so no one could be certain how long John Doe's remains had been in there, though it was estimated to be between a few days and a few weeks. Records showed that boiler number 9 was fired up on August the 9th, 18th, 19th, and 24th for a combined total of 16 hours. It then operated for 20 hours on September the 17th and 14 hours on September the 18th before the remains were discovered on September the 20th. But how did John Doe reach this particular location to begin with? Well, there was a metal hatch at the base of the chimney located 3 feet above where the remains were found. It took the police 2 hours to pry it open because the nuts on the hatch's bolts were rusty. The hatch was also locked, something which cannot be done from the inside, so it seemed very unlikely that John Doe used it to enter Stack 9. The chimney had a 4-foot lid at the top which was left open, so the victim likely fell accidentally, intentionally jumped, or was thrown down there by an unknown party. But what could have brought him there? Even though guards patrolled the mill's property, there weren't any security cameras, and no secure fencing alongside the railroad tracks next to the facility, so it wasn't particularly difficult for an outsider to enter the premises. While there were generally 4 to 6 employees on duty at a time, they often worked inside enclosed offices since the conditions were noisy. However, even though John Doe could have made it to Stack 9 undetected, it was not a particularly easy location to find. The route required him to either climb up 3 flights of stairs or ride a vertical conveyor belt inside the steam plant before they exited out onto the roof. After making their way across a catwalk, he would then have to use a ladder to reach the opening on top of the chimney or climb up there by using pipes or various handholds. While it appeared that John Doe may have had some inside knowledge of the facility, he definitely did not work there, as all employees at the mill were accounted for. The Bellingham PD searched through the mill's records for all past employees and private contractors dating back to December of 1985, but they did not find anyone who seemed like a potential match to the victim. During this time period, environmental groups have been protesting and measuring pollution at the mill, so investigators looked into the possibility that an individual from one of these groups could have sneaked onto the property and fallen into Stack 9, but none of them had any members who were reported missing. What made the situation even stranger is that no abandoned vehicles were found in the vicinity of the mill, so what did John Doe use as transportation to travel to this location? In November of 1987, when Unsolved Mysteries was just a series of individual specials airing on NBC and had not yet been turned into a full-time television series, the Bellingham Herald reported that officials from the show were asking for details about the case, though they ultimately never produced a segment about it. Over the next 2 decades, investigators would look into missing persons reports from all over the United States and Canada, hoping to find an individual who seemed like a promising candidate to be the Bellingham John Doe. A number of missing men were officially ruled out, and for the purposes of thoroughness, I'll be sharing their names later on in this episode. I will also mention a few missing individuals who have not been completely ruled out, though there isn't any concrete evidence to suggest they might be the decedent. In 2004, the Bellingham PD sent the victim's remains to the Washington State Patrol Crime Lab in hopes of extracting DNA from some of his bones for further analysis. Unfortunately, it turned out that the extreme heat inside the chimney had carbonized the remains, degrading the DNA so much that it was impossible to extract any samples. In August of that year, the Bellingham PD decided to officially close the case, stating they had, quote-unquote, determined that all investigative leads had been exhausted. John Doe's remains were subsequently cremated and interred in a common vault at the Green Acres Memorial Park Cemetery in Ferndale. But while there was no usable DNA available, investigators still have the victim's dental records on file in case they ever want to make a comparison with any individuals whom they believe might be John Doe. Even though the investigation was technically closed, this was definitely not the end of the story, as reporter Dean Kahn published a new article about the case in the October 30th, 2006 edition of the Bellingham Herald, and it helped pave the way for some intriguing new leads. After reading the article, a man named Robert Elvis Brown got in touch with the Bellingham PD and informed them that he had worked for the Mount Baker Plywood Mill in Bellingham in 1987. Sometime that year, Brown claimed that he met two men who were friends of his supervisor, and they told him that even though they were not employees of the Georgia-Pacific Pulp Mill, they were involved in a group who liked to sneak onto the mill's property and climb the smokestacks for fun. They told Brown that one member of their group worked at the mill and would let them into the facility after hours. If they ever got separated and ran into a situation where they were in danger of being caught by a security patrol or law enforcement, they had developed a system which involved blowing a whistle to warn the other members of the group. Once everyone heard the whistle, they would scatter off in different directions and try to leave the property before meeting up again at a prearranged location. According to Brown, these two men told him that a guy from New York State had become a member of their group, and during their most recent excursion to the mill, someone blew a whistle, so they all went off in separate directions. But when they later met up at their prearranged location, the guy from New York didn't show up, and they never heard from him again. Brown was certain that his conversation with these two men occurred after the John Doe's remains were found at the Georgia-Pacific Mill, and while he recalled contacting someone from the Bellingham PD about this, there did not seem to be any record of this on file. Brown said he did not know the names of the two men or anyone else from their so-called group, but he seemed to think that the supervisor at the Mount Baker Mill who was friends with these guys was named Larson. Alan Jensen, the lead detective on this case at the time, spoke with personnel from Mount Baker, but no one working at the company could recall a supervisor named Larson, and there were no records for any employees by that name who worked at the plywood mill back in 1987. Jensen also got in touch with the New York State Police's Violent Crime Analysis Program and Forensic Investigation Center to inquire about individuals who had gone missing during the 1980s and matched the description of John Doe. Jensen received information about five missing men from that time period, but it does not sound like any of them had dental records on file in order to make a comparison to the decedent. On November 12, 2006, Dean Kahn published a follow-up article about the case in the Bellingham Herald, which revealed that another interesting lead had been provided by a man named Richard Severson. During the late summer of 1987, Severson was working as an engineer at the steam plant at Western Washington University in Bellingham and claimed that an unidentified woman suddenly showed up at his workplace one day. He described her as being around 35 to 40 years old, between 5'4 and 5'6, and having brown hair, blue eyes, and a thin build. She also wore a windbreaker-type jacket, blue jeans, a knitted-type blouse or shirt, and canvas-type tennis shoes. Severson said that the woman simply smiled and wouldn't say anything, but when he asked if she wanted to take a tour of the plant, she nodded in agreement. The woman soon asked to see the inside of an active boiler, so Severson took her to one and proceeded to lift her up so she could see the flames through a viewing window. The woman then asked to see an inactive boiler, so Severson complied, and when they arrived, she asked if she could climb inside. Severson allowed her to do so, and she proceeded to go in and sit down on the pipes, before she inexplicably decided to keep exiting and re-entering the boiler five or six more times. Severson found the woman's behavior to be so odd that he asked her to leave, but told her that if she was interested in seeing how steam plants operated, she could check out the Georgia Pacific Pulp Mill, which was located only 1 mile north of the university. Severson said that he did go to the Western Washington University police to report this woman's behavior, but since no crime had been committed, there was nothing they could do. Severson never saw the woman again, but when he heard about the discovery of the remains at the Georgia Pacific Mill weeks later, he began to wonder if the victim may have been burned so badly that the authorities were mistaken about her gender, and she was actually a Jane Doe instead of a John Doe. Severson claimed that he did come forward and spoke to a pair of detectives from the Bellingham PD about this, but they dismissed his account because they were certain that the victim was male. Indeed, the deputy medical examiner, Dr. Robert Gibb, had reached this conclusion based on the measurements of the victim's pelvis, which is the method most commonly used for determining the sex of skeletal remains. Shortly after Severson shared his story in 2006, Dr. Gibb agreed to re-examine photographs of the remains, but he continued to hold to his original conclusion that the decedent was male. As for the Georgia Pacific Pulp Mill, it wound up being closed down in 2001, and the steam plant was demolished 10 years after that. Like I mentioned earlier, DNA testing is not an option in this case, but the John Doe's dental records are still on file, and composite sketches featuring the two forensic reconstructions of what the victim may have looked like are available for viewing online at such websites as the Doe Network. There is still hope that someone might recognize him someday and direct the authorities towards a promising match, but after more than 35 years, the Bellingham John Doe continues to remain unidentified. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. Anyway, I think it goes without saying that this is one of the weirdest cases you're ever going to find involving an unidentified decedent. These past several years, we've seen a number of cases in which John and Jane Doe's have been identified, but since some of these decedents were the victims of homicide, and we still don't know the identity of their killer, the mystery is technically only half solved. But the story of the Bellingham John Doe is multiple mysteries rolled up into one. In addition to not knowing his identity, we still don't know if he was the victim of a homicide, suicide, or an accidental death. And most importantly, we have no idea why his remains wound up in such an unusual location, or why he would have been there to begin with. Given the amount of decedents who have been identified in recent years via genetic genealogy, I do think there's a good chance that if the Bellingham John Doe had DNA available, we might already know who he is by now. From an official standpoint, the Bellingham Police Department's investigation into this case was closed back in 2004 because without DNA evidence, they figured there was very little else they could do to try and get him identified. But while investigators are no longer actively pursuing new leads, it sounds like they are still willing to explore new leads which are brought to their attention. In fact, this is pretty much what happened in 2006 when Robert Elvis Brown shared his story about the John Doe possibly being from New York. If someone were to come forward who believed they knew the identity of the John Doe and this individual's dental records were available, I'm sure the authorities would be more than happy to make a comparison. But otherwise, without any new information to work with, it sounds like trying to identify this guy would be the equivalent of searching for a needle in a haystack. To their credit, the Bellingham PD have done a very thorough job of searching through missing persons cases from all over the continent in hopes of finding a match to John Doe, but most of their candidates have been ruled out for a number of different reasons. In order to get this information out there, here is a list of men who went missing and were officially eliminated as being the Bellingham John Doe following an investigation. Norman J. Bouillon, Joseph Kirby Morris, Eric E. Holm, Jeff Layton, Edward Cost, Henry Hurley, Mike Ford, John Michael Feathers, Jack McDonald, Ronald Raby, Billy Stoner, James D. Brown, James Hansard, Dennis C. McNeil, Joseph K. Morris, Dana Torgerson, Joseph Terracone, and Jackie Letney. Now, there are at least two other missing men from the United States who have been investigated And even though it's a long shot that either of them is the John Doe, they have still not been completely ruled out. One of them is 56-year-old Robert Wayne Keenan, who went missing from Seattle on November the 28th, 1981. There's almost no information available about his case, but given that Keenan was about 20 years older than John Doe's estimated age and went missing nearly 6 years earlier, I seriously doubt that it's him. The other individual I want to mention is Lee Pascal Woodard, a 41-year-old alcoholic who was last seen in Nashville, Tennessee on August 15, 1987, though he was not officially reported missing until May of 1991. Once again, there's virtually no information about this disappearance, and since John Doe seemed to have a plane ticket in his possession when he died, you certainly can't dismiss anyone because they lived on the other side of the country. The Bellingham PD did apparently request that Woodard's case file be searched for his dental records, but I'm guessing that no comparison was ever made, as Woodard has never been completely ruled out. Since Bellingham is just over 20 miles south of the Washington-British Columbia border, investigators have also explored the possibility that John Doe was from Canada. One potential candidate was 28-year-old David Glenn Harrington, who traveled from Calgary, Alberta to Vancouver to visit his mother in April of 1986, before he went missing. Harrington lived a transient lifestyle and was described as suffering from severe emotional problems which prevented him from settling down, so it's not beyond the realm of possibility that someone like this could travel across the border into Washington and somehow wound up inside a chimney at a pulp mill. In 2000, the Bellingham PD coordinated with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in order to obtain a DNA sample from Harrington's family, though of course it later turned out that John Doe had no usable DNA to compare it to. At one point, the Vancouver Police Department temporarily took possession of John Doe's skull in an attempt to create a forensic reconstruction and compare it to records of Harrington's skull, but the results were inconclusive, and as far as I can tell, no dental records could be located for Harrington. The Bellingham PD did contact the U.S. Customs Office and Border Protection to see if Harrington ever crossed the border from Canada into the States after April of 1986. They confirmed that there was no record of this in their system, but also acknowledged that since border security was less stringent back then, Harrington could have entered the U.S. without it being documented by officials. So yes, the possibility of him being John Doe is pretty remote, but he hasn't been completely ruled out. So whenever there's a story involving an unidentified John or Jane Doe, you'll always find amateur sleuths who comb through missing persons profiles and try to find potential matches to the decedent. If you search online discussions about this particular case, you'll find two men from Washington State who have profile pages at the major missing persons websites such as the Charlie Project and the Doe Network, and are often pushed forward as candidates to be the Bellingham John Doe. I've seen no mention of either of these men in the case file, so I have no idea if they've ever been investigated by law enforcement. But I figured I should mention them anyway, just to get their names out there, because regardless of whether or not they're John Doe, they are still missing. One of them is 30-year-old Alan Hill, who vanished in Thurston County near the town of Yelm in 1987. Hill was apparently last seen at a tavern on Harris Road, and while other residents indicated that he had been planning to drive to Seattle, he left behind all of his belongings at his residence. Yelm is located about 150 miles south of Bellingham, but unfortunately, there seems to be a discrepancy about the actual date Hill went missing. The Doe Network lists the date as September the 18th, which is interesting timing, since this was only 2 days before John Doe's remains were discovered. But the Charlie Project lists the date as October the 9th, and if this is accurate, this would obviously rule out Hill as the decedent. The other missing individual I've seen mentioned in online discussions is 42-year-old Archer Johnson, who vanished on April the 1st, 1986, from the hamlet of Brooklyn, which is nearly 200 miles southwest of Bellingham. Looking at photographs of Johnson, I can definitely see a resemblance between him and the forensic reconstructions of John Doe, but his abandoned truck was discovered on a remote logging road, and the circumstances of how he went missing seemed to point to him becoming a victim of foul play. So I don't find it very likely that he would wind up in a chimney in another section of the state 17 months later. Whoever the Bellingham John Doe was, I have a feeling you're not going to find a profile page for him on the Doe Network or the Charlie Project or Namus. But before we go any further trying to figure out this man's identity, let's see if you can try to make some sense out of the circumstances of how he died. The one thing which seems certain is that given the condition of his remains, John Doe had to be in Stack 9 for at least 2 days before he was found, because the last time the boiler flared up was on September the 18th. But since no one from the mill ever checked the chimney, there's no way of knowing how long he was down there, as it could have been days or weeks. Since the fall was 17 feet, it probably did not kill him, as there's evidence that he attempted to treat his injuries and climb out. It's believed that his exact cause of death was hyperthermia, and since the temperatures down there were always high, I'd like to think that he passed on relatively quickly without suffering too much and didn't have to experience the ordeal of the boiler generating unbearable heat. Since the plant was known for being noisy, and employees rarely ventured near Stack 9, even if John Doe cried out for help, no one would have heard him. I think we can rule out the idea of him being killed at another location before someone dumped him into the chimney. Yes, it technically would be an ideal place to dispose of a body, as the superintendent of the steam plant told police that he believed the odds of winning the lottery would have been greater than someone actually looking down into Stack 9 and noticing the remains, particularly since you would need to use a flashlight. However, given the amount of climbing required to reach the steam plant's roof and the top of the chimney, I seriously doubt that anyone would go to the trouble of lugging a dead person all the way up there. The only way a homicide theory makes sense is if someone killed John Doe at that location or deliberately pushed him into Stack 9, but even so, you would still have to climb a ladder to reach the opening. It actually wouldn't be that hard to believe a scenario involving foul play and a cover-up if John Doe had been an employee at the mill, but investigators were able to account for pretty much everyone who worked there during the previous 2 years. Whoever this man was, he definitely seemed like an outsider, but in order to make it to the location where he was found, you have to wonder if he had knowledge of the facility. So if John Doe's death was not a homicide or an accidental fall, I guess an alternate theory is that it could have been a suicide, though there are much easier ways to end your own life than breaking into a steam plant and jumping into one of the chimneys. Yes, suicidal people don't always make the most rational decisions, but like I just mentioned, the drop into the chimney was only 17 feet and unlikely to cause instantaneous death. Instead, you would just wind up trapped inside a confined location with broken bones and brutally hot temperatures and suffer a slow, agonizing death. Unless John Doe was making a calculated attempt to try and ensure his remains would never be found, why not just do something simpler, like jump off the roof? Now obviously, since he was nothing more than bones by the time he was found, no toxicology report could be performed to see if the decedent had any drugs or alcohol in his system. One theory which has been pushed forward is that John Doe could have been under the influence of hallucinogenic drugs when he made an illogical decision to jump into Stack 9. We only bring this up because there is mention of the possibility of hallucinogenic drugs in the original autopsy report. I know there have always been a number of over-the-top urban legends involving LSD, including the idea that taking the drug can fool people into believing they can fly and prompt them to jump off high places. I guess it's tempting to believe that a man under the influence of LSD would dive into a chimney, but there is no evidence to support this idea at all. And I'm sure the idea that hallucinogenic drugs will make you think you can fly was mostly just based on a moral panic, and there are very few, if any, actual documented cases of this. So back in 2006, two interesting theories came out about who the Bellingham John Doe might be and how they wound up in Stack 9. Of course, one of them explores the possibility that John Doe may have been a Jane Doe, as we have the account from Richard Severson, who gave a tour of the Western Washington University steam plant to a woman who seemed to have an odd obsession with climbing inside boilers. Since this incident took place in the weeks prior to the discovery of the decedent's remains, and Severson said he told this woman about the Georgia Pacific pulp mill, perhaps she went there and decided to enter the chimney for some reason. The second theory is based on the account from Robert Elvis Brown, who said he spoke to two men who were involved in a group that liked to enter the Georgia Pacific pulp mill in the middle of the night to climb the smokestacks, but on one of these excursions, they became separated from a group member who hailed from New York State and they never heard from him again. Of course, it's easy to be skeptical about these stories, as neither of them became public knowledge until after the Bellingham Herald published an article about the case 19 years after the fact. However, Severson and Brown both claimed that they attempted to share their accounts with law enforcement back in 1987, but it didn't lead anywhere. Obviously, the woman and the guy from New York both can't be the decedent, but each story provides a potential explanation for how the victim wound up in the chimney, and they're so odd that you wonder if these witnesses could have possibly dreamed up something like that. I mean, on the surface, it does sound outlandish that this strange woman would show up unannounced at Severson's workplace without saying one word, and instead of calling security, he says, "Hey, how about I give you a tour of the place?" On the other hand, if Severson just decided to fabricate this entire story for attention, why wouldn't he say that a man showed up there rather than a woman? Why make an attempt to try and change the known facts of the case? Obviously, even if the story about the woman is true, it might not have any relevance, since Dr. Gibb was so certain that the remains belonged to a male. But it's worth reiterating that he came to this conclusion by measuring the victim's pelvis, which is the most common practice for determining sex in these situations. This is because a woman's pelvis is broader and lighter than a man's and has a wider pelvic cavity, so this method is believed to have a 95% accuracy rate. All that being said, 95% is not 100%, and mistakes do happen. As you might recall, on episode number 269 of the podcast last year, I covered the unexplained death of 20-year-old Patrick Rosner, who vanished from Winnipeg, Manitoba in June of 1989, before his skeletal remains were eventually found in a remote field over 220 kilometers away. However, Patrick was not actually identified for over two decades, because investigators initially believed that the victim was female. They spent years cross-checking Patrick's remains with cold cases involving missing women, and it was not until they performed DNA testing when they realized that the victim was actually male. Since we've never had the luxury of extracting DNA samples from the victim in this case, who's to say that another mistake didn't occur? I would be curious if investigators explored this possibility and double-checked to see if there were any missing women who could have been potential candidates to be the Bellingham decedent. Overall, I do think that's a long shot, and the decedent was probably male all along, but Severson's description of the woman's odd behavior does make her sound like the type of person who would end up inside a chimney on a boiler. So the story provided by Robert Elvis Brown is equally weird, but if he had been able to accurately remember the names of the two men he spoke to, or the supervisor they were supposedly friends with, there might have been something there. I don't know if people were just hard up for entertainment in Bellingham back in 1987, but making unauthorized entries into a pulp mill in order to climb smokestacks in the middle of the night does seem like an odd way to pass the time. But if this story was true, it would go a long way towards explaining how the John Doe wound up in Stack 9 and why no one has ever identified him. I mean, even if these two men were acquainted with the John Doe and learned about what happened to him in the media, he died while they were trespassing and performing crazy stunts on private property, so I can understand them not coming forward. The two men also said there was an employee at the mill who would let them into the facility after hours, and this person would have had their own reasons for staying silent, though if they were questioned by police during the original investigation, they obviously didn't arouse any suspicion. What's odd is that Brown was certain that his interaction with these men took place after John Doe's remains had been discovered. Granted, it's possible they had not yet learned about it from the news, but if they had, you'd think they would be inclined to keep their mouths shut and not talk about their acquaintance from New York, particularly with someone like Brown, whom they didn't even know. If the John Doe really was an outsider from New York, then I would be curious to know how he became acquainted with this group to begin with. If they barely knew him, why invite him along on secret excursions where they're climbing smokestacks on private property? But if they were friends with this man and knew him fairly well, why didn't they grow more concerned over the fact that he seemed to vanish without a trace after they became separated at the mill? However, if he really was from the other side of the country and did not reside in Washington, that would go a long way towards explaining why he's never been identified. The main reason it seems plausible that John Doe was an outsider is because there were burnt remnants of an airline ticket or baggage claim slip found near his remains. I know an additional theory which has been pushed forward is that John Doe may have been a homeless person or transient who decided to venture onto the pulp mill's property because he needed a place to keep warm. That could very well still be true, but there's also plenty of evidence to suggest that the victim was fairly well off at some point, such as the airline ticket and the fact that he had undergone extensive dental work. We've never been able to account for how John Doe traveled to the mill, as there were no abandoned vehicles found in the area, and as far as I know, no outside party, such as a taxi driver, ever admitted giving him a ride to this location. But Bellingham does have an international airport located about 5 miles from where the pulp mill was, so maybe he arrived in town shortly before his death, and then, for reasons unknown, decided to pay a visit to the facility. Robert Elvis Brown's story sounds absurd on the surface, yet if the John Doe really was a New Yorker who went to the mill for some sort of odd group activity which involved climbing smokestacks, and he just happened to fall to his death inside one of these stacks, this scenario would explain many of the oddities about this case. Unfortunately, we just don't have any corroborating evidence to back this story up, but if there are actually other people out there, like those two unidentified men, who know the truth about what happened to John Doe and have remained silent for over 35 years, then there is still a chance that he could be identified. Regardless of whether or not this account is true, I am inclined to believe that John Doe's death was a result of some sort of tragic accident, but if he was not participating in a group activity and was on the property alone when this happened, then that will make it more difficult to figure out how his death occurred and solve this mystery. In a lot of the cases from the past few years where John and Jane Doe's have been identified, it turned out these victims did have family members who attempted to search for them and find out what happened. But they would run into obstacles when they tried to file an official report with the police, who often held the mentality that since these missing individuals were adults, they had the legal right to disappear and cut off all contact with their families if they wanted to. So perhaps the Bellingham John Doe has a family out there who have been trying to find him for 3 decades, but just haven't put 2 and 2 together. While this particular victim cannot be identified via genetic genealogy, one alternative option is that someone who once knew him personally may come across the sketches of his facial reconstructions online and recognize him. Granted, these reconstructions were based on skeletal remains, so we don't know how accurate they are, but you cannot deny that he's a fairly distinctive-looking individual, so maybe one of these days, the right person will see the sketches, and a light bulb will go off over their head. Remember, the option to identify him via dental records is still there. Until that takes place, this will continue to remain one of the oddest cold cases you'll ever find involving an unidentified decedent. Once again, another very special thanks to my source for providing me with all the documentation related to this case. The more information about this story that gets out there, the better chance there is of this man being identified. So if you happen to have any information about the identity of the Bellingham John Doe, please contact the Bellingham Police Department at 360-778-8800. That's 360-778-8800. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, we released a top 10 list-themed bonus episode where I count down the top 10 surprising twists on unsolved mysteries. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my 2 co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1994 murders of Michael Johnston and Rochelle Robinson. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon these past few weeks, and they are Dan M., F. Wilson, Emily P., ABN, Matt C., Selena J., Kelly J., Michelle, and Mike L. Thank you all so much for your support. Anyway, I previously announced that The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival later this year, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. Well, we've now got a specialized promo code which you can use in order to get a 15% discount on tickets to the event. So if you would like to purchase tickets, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com and use our promo code TRAIL in order to get a 15% discount. Once again, that's truecrimepodcastfestival.com and the promo code is TRAIL. Hope to see you there. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.